Blog Talk
Good evening.
Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Ethics Talk. Tonight's topic is the essay Self-Reliance by Ralph Waldo Emerson. We've been doing a segment on Emerson here for the past few weeks at Ethics Talk, and this is one of his more lauded essays, less obscure, by our lights. I'm very thankful to be joined tonight by Dr. Michael Russo. Would you like to say hi, Doctor?
Hello.
As well as Dr. Hope May.
Hi.
She's a little shy. This is your first time tuning into Ethics Talk. This is a talk show, so just because we're talking doesn't mean you can't call in. Feel free to give us a call. The number is
646-727-3928.
And if you'd like to follow along on the essay, it is posted on our website, ethicstalk.cmish.edu. Under show resources, you can get the full PDF, and we'll frequently cite page numbers, etc., so you can read right along with us. That being said, I think Dr. Russo is going to kick the show off tonight.
Okay, well, the title of the essay here is Self-Reliance, and throughout this whole discussion, Emerson is stressing the importance of trusting yourself, relying on yourself. As he says at one point, I believe it's on page one, it's in the very beginning of the paper, something to the effect that we must learn how to watch for and listen to those flashes of like insight or genius in ourselves, and not just to be like dazzled, so to speak, by what other sages and bards and poets have said. So not to be transfixed by the wise sayings of other people, but to be able to find it and hear it in yourself. And we all thought that a good way to start an approach into what he has to say would be to think of an example of someone who lived that way, or some action that exemplifies this kind of like self-trust as against sort of social pressures. One of the things Emerson returns to a few times, like earlier on in the essay, is he says at one point something like, society is everywhere against the manhood of its members, and there's like a conspiracy, so to speak, of the average man, so to say, or society overall, against the innovation that like a genius will always produce, something to this effect in any event. So an example of someone whose life story, so to speak, exemplifies this self-reliance is, among many other people, surely, but just one example, is a Indian philosopher named Krishnamurti. And early in his life, when he was, I think, about like 8 years old or so, a group of people known as the Theosophical Society determined through what means, I couldn't exactly say, they perceived his aura or something to this effect, and determined that Krishnamurti was the next vehicle, so to speak, of the world teacher, sort of like a messiah-like figure, that he was going to lead the world in this next age by spreading some like new form of wisdom and essentially like founding a new religion. And so he was like 8 years old when they discovered him, quote-unquote, and they raised him up and, you know, brought him to England and had him educated, and their Theosophical Society was a pretty, like, big thing, and so it was very popular, and they announced this, you know, that he was the one, they had found him, and so a lot of their reputation was, like, on the line, so to speak. And after a long time, I think he was about, I forget what his age was at this point, maybe it was, like, 29, I can't remember, it was like, okay, the time has come, you know, he's ready. They formed a special organization around him as like the new world teacher, and it was the big day. He's going to come out and like deliver it, the message, and start, you know, this new age. So they're all gathered, and what does he say? He says, this whole thing, in effect, is completely wrong, and I herewith dissolve the whole order. And, I mean, his action and also what he was saying in his words were significant to the theme of this essay by Emerson, because in his speech on that day he said, the title of it was Truth is a Pathless Land, and he was saying, you can't find truth by following someone else's instructions or following some like prefabricated set of doctrines. You have to like use your own energy and dedicate yourself to finding it yourself, or else you'll never find it. And one thing that he said that I think is really profound, especially I'm sure like in the context and at that moment, everyone like waiting for what the message would be and ready for this, you know, divine revelation. And he said, "You were prepared to believe anything I was going to say today. You're ready to just believe anything except what I'm telling you now," which is, you can't just believe what I'm telling you. You have to, like, figure it out on your own. And so in doing that, I think this is an example of, you know, he had a deep struggle in himself before he did that about whether or not he should do that. I mean, if you think about the context in a concrete sort of way, I mean, these people had, like, brought him up, and he was really close with them, and the one woman, Annie Besant, who was like the president of the Theosophical Society at that time, was like a mother to him kind of thing. And so it wasn't just like he thought they were a bunch of idiots and he decided that he would just blow the whole thing up, you know. It took a great struggle to be like authentic and to be sincere with himself and to bring that out and to break down this whole thing that had been built up for him. And it was all on the grounds, in a way, you could say, borrowing from Emerson, that, you know, you have to be self-reliant in finding the truth. You can't follow someone else and, like, join an organization and expect that to, like, really do anything for you in itself. And so I think that's a good example of an act where someone had, you know, had to have courage to do a thing that was, like, true to himself in spite of a lot of pressure, you know, worldwide. He's, like, renowned as some great new figure to, like, go against that, and that exemplifies that in a nice way.
Yes, I know that Mike, that is Quag's dad, not Dr. Russo, has some thoughts about the accuracy of Emerson's emphasis on the self and self-reliance. And I want to try to get us to that by, you know, this, what you were saying about Krishnamurti, Dr. Russo, and how, what is her name? Annie Besant?
Right.
Okay. And so, like, this woman raised Krishnamurti and whatnot, and this was a struggle within him because this was, like, his family. And he was really, you know, dissing his family in a way. Maybe in the long run he was really helping them. But in any case, there's a line in Emerson's Self-Reliance, and it's really page 3, if you're interested in, I think, a page that really gets at, you know, the emphasis that Emerson places on the individual as opposed to others. And there's a line where he actually says, "I shun father and mother and wife and brother when genius calls me." It's right in the middle of the page, page 3. I'll read it again. "I shun father and mother and wife and brother when genius calls me." So in the hierarchy of values that is implicit in this essay, you have genius at the top, and the relationship to genius is more important, more weighty than relationships to, quote, significant others. And Mike Klagstad, could you, I know you have some thoughts about that. Do you want to say anything?
Well, actually, an anecdote just came to me, so I'm literally just throwing this out there on the fly, so I hope it sits well, it sparkles with all the girls. When I was a young child, probably between 6 and 8, my grandfather was a carpenter. He was a retired teacher, and his, you know, hobby of choice, although it was more than a hobby for him, was carpentry. He was always in his wood shop making things. And, of course, you know, he had neuropathy and diabetes and all these other things. So while his mind was very sharp, his appendages, his fingers, were not. So at a very young age, you know, I learned my way around a bandsaw and a table saw and these sorts of things. And I'd often work the machines. And oftentimes, I was somewhat precocious, maybe not always in a good way. And, you know, I'd have these different ideas about things, and I would always, you know, run them by Grandpa. We'd be building a signpost or something like this, and I'd say, "Oh, Grandpa, what if we did it this way?" And one of the interesting things about our relationship is he was always up for it, no matter what it was. Yeah, let's give it a whirl. He would always, you know, at least entertain the idea. Now, interestingly enough, sometimes I had some novel concepts. Now, I'm sure, you know, they were nothing It's not like I, you know, had the first manned flight or anything like that. But I'd come up with, you know, some new approach to something he'd been doing for years now and again. And, you know, he'd start thinking about different ways to do it. And he'd say, you know, you're always thinking, son, very good idea. But about 9 times out of 10, it was a terrible idea. And he would explain to me why. You know, we'd go through it, we'd give it a shot, it wouldn't work. And, of course, he knew all along it wasn't going to work, but he wanted me to see it for myself. And he'd explain to me, you know, well, this is why it went wrong. You know, the wood was not dense enough or something like that, you know, and the nails split it. And I knew it was going to happen. What we should have done is we should have drilled through it first. Well, I guess my point, long story short, now it's too late, but...
That's a great story. I'm entranced.
Okay. Yeah. My point is just that, to this specific quote from Emerson, I shun father and mother and wife and brother when my genius calls me. Very often in my own experience, there's nothing like a good sounding board when genius strikes. You know, what seems like genius often ends up being folly, in my experience. And, you know, the time and trouble and visits to the hospital that my grandfather saved me in many of these circumstances, I think, was invaluable. I guess this says a lot about my overall view of Emerson's essay. I'm a little bit skeptical. But while I do certainly think there's something to be said for being novel, you know, and not being afraid to go against the grain, so to speak, I think, you know, turning yourself into a hermit for the extent of your genius might be a mistake. That's just my personal opinion.
Excellent. Dr. Russo, do you want to say anything?
Well, first of all, that was a great story. I felt like I was actually in that wood shop with you myself. It was very nicely told. but, I mean, I agree with your point, and I think that's definitely good. I think Emerson, you know, at times, he seems to definitely want to really, like, hammer it home and go for it. And sometimes maybe it's like he kind of goes overboard. But I think, you know, what can I say? I think it's somewhat in spirit with what he's saying, that there might be a time for going overboard and going too far and exaggerating to make a point. And, I mean, I wouldn't be able to say, not really knowing the details, you know, about the, like, the time and the context, but... I don't know. Someone else might know, but surely knows better than I do. You know, at that time and place, maybe it's like people needed to really hear, like, an overblown statement to this effect about self-reliance and not just, like, regurgitating what other people have said and so on and so forth. I mean, I think it's significant that he often says things like in the American Scholar that we talked about a couple shows ago. He says something like, you know, give me what is the contemporary truth or something like that, and you can have all of antiquity or whatever. I think you read that line from American Scholar last time. And he says things like that, but I think it's significant that, you know, he knows about all that stuff himself, so he's read it. So it's not like he's saying that somehow it should all be trashed and it's bad to, you know, learn from other people. But I think he's maybe reacting to a situation where people have erred, like, too far on the side of just repeating and interpreting what other people have said, and then everyone just stops listening to their own genius and doing something new, and so he's going to, like, go all the way the other way and emphasize it, you know, completely.
Yeah, if I may, that rings true because of on that page, on page 3, where he says, I shun father and mother and wife and brother when genius calls me, he's also talking about the cause of abolition, that is, of slavery. And this is something that I know very little about, but and the way that we got on to Emerson was through the reading of the book The Metaphysical Club, which is on our show resources page under one of our, a link to it at any rate, under one of our earlier Emerson shows, I think maybe the first one, on the American Scholar, where we actually played a clip from the audio version of that book. But I remember in that book, the author is saying that at first, Emerson was actually against abolition, because he saw it as a conformist movement. And it bothered him that people would just sort of, quote, mindlessly go to either the abolitionist or the pro-slavery side. And this is an address given in 1841, so that could be, you know, the context of this. But also another thing that supports this idea that maybe he's just making this point for rhetorical purposes, but he also does value others, like people who point out to us that we're wrong. In his essay on friendship, which we have not read or discussed, he makes a statement about a true friend, and he uses this phrase that I believe we have used on this show before, beautiful enemy. And he basically says a true friend is a beautiful enemy. He's devoutly revered, I'm reading this, his essay on friendship, and not a trivial conveniency to be soon outgrown and cast aside. And so the true friend is someone that you can really learn from. He says in this paragraph that there are people who will engage in idle chit-chat with you, but like the true friend and companion is one who really nourishes you. And he definitely, insofar as he has an essay on friendship, one would conclude from that that he values others. Okay, so I just wanted to make those points that, maybe he's just, like Dr. Russo was saying, trying to exaggerate this point because it's not being talked about enough. It's maybe a counterweight to the mood of the time.
And if I could just drive this point home, I think it's already been done enough. But that, you know, my criticism of Emerson might not be entirely fair. One of my own observations of the essay was that he wasn't as careful in this essay as he has been in other essays about, I guess, protecting himself from these sorts of opposing views. And as Dr. Russo and Dr. May have so eloquently put it, he's sort of counterweighting this overwhelming view he's getting of, you know, following the monotonous powers that be. And to just get a little bit more of Emerson's essay into our conversation here, right off page one, I don't think we'll get another chance to talk about it. He frames his essay on self-reliance after just having read, he says a painter, but maybe a poet, something like this, after just having read some Plato, Milton, Moses, these sorts of people. He states that a man should learn to detect and watch that gleam of light which flashes across his mind from within, more than the luster or the firmament of bards and sages. Dr. Russo was hinting to that line earlier. But his point is, look, you know, when you're reading these people, listen to yourself, listen to your thoughts. And he goes on to say, yet he dismisses without notice his own thought, because it is his. In every work of genius, we recognize our own rejected thoughts. They have come back to us with a certain alienated majesty. So his point now is like, yeah, you know, I thought that myself, but somebody else said it, so I'm just going to, you know, put my own brain on mute for a while and finish the rest of his book or poem or whatever it is. Well, that's not the right course, he says. Great works of art have no more affecting lesson for us than this. They teach us to abide by our spontaneous impression with good-humored inflexibility than most when the whole cry of voices is on the other side. Else, tomorrow, a stranger will say with masterly good sense precisely what we have thought and felt at the time, and we shall be forced to take with shame our own opinion from another. So I think this is his sort of call to arms that Dr. Russo and Dr. May were talking about. You know, he's sort of really sticking it in the gut and saying, come on, don't be so afraid of your own thoughts.
And maybe it's, oh, P.S., this is an attempt at humor, okay? So everybody laugh after I say this. But, you know, reading this, I thought this is exactly what I felt when I learned Tarski's truth theorem. Dr. Russo, I don't know if you remember the traditional example that's used, but it's snow is white in quotes equals snow is white without quotes. And this is like some, you know, grand theorem that was proven. And I thought, well, I knew that, but anyway. But I silenced my opinion because blah, blah, blah. But what I think is so wonderful about this passage, and you know what, we can just stay on page one and I'd be happy. There's so much here. But it could be the case, like going back to this the value of other people. So we've said that, like your grandfather, Mike, that he explained to you why ideas were bad,
right.
And that's definitely valuable. And the whole idea of a beautiful enemy is that, right? Because they're beautiful because they're explaining to you why you're going in the wrong way. Tal Ben-Shahar actually uses the phrase, we all need a board of beautiful enemies because we have blind spots and we need true friends to tell us, no, like you're doing something wrong. And he gets this idea from Emerson, Tal Ben-Shahar does. But it could also be the case that another value that others provide to us is that, and maybe this is sad, you know, I hear about Tarski and I think, well, I thought that before. Or we read something and we think, well, I had that idea. I mean, although there's something sad about it, because he concludes the sentence, we shall be forced to take with shame our own opinion from another. It could be the case that you go, well, I've had that idea before, and, well, gosh darn it, I'm going to do something about it. So it could be the case that when you recognize other people have the same ideas that you do, that that perhaps empowers you in a way to actually take action, period. That's all I have to say.
So I guess I'll just go ahead and grab the reins here. So to answer our question, according to Emerson, what would self-reliance look like?
Mm-hmm.
There's this idea of, you know, not being beaten down by the academics, the professionals, the powers that be. We're taking him a little less literally on the whole,
mm-hmm.
I cast out my mother and father when genius strikes. Perhaps we'll need to do our own rendition of On Friendship to answer that question. What else? What are we missing? What are the other components?
One thing to just throw in that might, provide a more, tempered way of reading that statement about casting out the mother and father and so on. It's like, you know, how to put it, it's a real question or problem that many people face when, I mean, obviously, if your relationships with other people somehow impede your development, then, yeah, you have, like, a real problem. And you have to decide. It's like, are you going to pursue your own true destiny or what have you, or work on the things that are, like, really what is, you know, the truth for you or your real pursuit in life, or like give it up because it inconveniences somebody else, like your parents don't like it or whatever. And I think, you know, it maybe his point is less like, you know, I disregard my parents and my friends and everyone else because, like, who cares about them? Like, I'm a genius. And more like, you know, when they come in conflict, if one has to be sacrificed, if you sacrifice yourself, it'll never really turn out good in the end, even for the other people, because your relationship will be based on something like false and wrong and I don't know. That's
so contrary to the prayer of St. Francis, but regardless.
Okay. Well, right. I mean, that's like a charitable way to read what he's saying, and at the same time, it's like, I don't know, maybe there's like nobility in sacrificing for another person on in whatever.
I feel us approaching the theme of inconsistency.
Okay.
So what you're saying is this a fair interpretation of what you're saying? When he says, I shun father and mother and wife and brother when genius calls me, he's really saying, here's the question. Are fathers and mothers and wives and brothers who don't help you along with your inner genius bad? Bad fathers and mothers and wives and brothers. Are they bad?
Well, to quote Emerson, page 3, basically smack dab in the middle of the page, truth is handsomer than the affection of love. So even still, we read it even more charitably, not even saying bad mother, bad father, just that, look, your own quest for the truth is going to be worth more than your love for them is.
I think, though, actually, I'm not looking at the page, but I think it says, Truth is more important than the affectation of love, like a fake.
That's right.
Fake, you know, when you, like, put on the appropriate face you feel like you're supposed to have instead of, like, expressing how you really feel, it's like an affectation of love, and it's better to just bring out the truth, even if it's, like, inconvenient or harder to deal with, than it is to just, like, fake your way through it, because that'll never really be good.
Mm. Well, going back to this question of, okay, what does the person who's self-reliant and trusts him or herself look like? Okay, so they are casting aside, to some extent, society and customs and relatives insofar as they interfere with one's progression as a genius. And I also want to say, since we're talking about genius, you may think, you know, Einstein. But on page one, going back to page one, he defines genius. It is like the third sentence, maybe fourth. But in any case, he says, to believe your own thought, to believe that what is true for you in your private heart is true for all men, that is genius. So you don't have to be a rocket scientist. All you have to do is believe in your heart that what is true for you is true for all. So you're coming into some contact with universal truth or what have you. But in any case, people who interfere with that are bad, and you should cast them aside, and this sort of self-pursuit trumps that. But I also wanted to say that another facet of the self-reliant individual who trusts themselves pertains to the thorny notion of consistency and inconsistency, and I will leave it to Mike or Dr. Russo to take up that thread. Anybody want to start on that one?
Well, I guess I'll go ahead and jump into the fire on that one. Very central to this conversation about self-reliance that is inherent in Emerson is this idea of conformity. Now, I know that's not exactly where you're going with consistency or inconsistency, but he's resisting conformity as much as he is backing self-reliance. And I think that's interesting. Along in this formula for what a self-relying individual would look like, he gives a few other examples. One metaphor he uses is he basically says, be like an infant. Kind of interesting, you know, fits with the idea of genius, you know, spontaneous creation. You can see it. But his real point, or what I took away from his metaphor, was be the infant who, you know, has the adults all, I forget his exact term, something like prattle over him or something like that. Like, let these adults fuss over you, not vice versa. Mm-hmm. When, you know, you are off and running and doing your genius work, catch their attention and don't by any means, you know, follow their rules.
Yeah, I have the passage. It's so great. It's the last sentence on the first full paragraph on page two. Do not think the youth has no force because he cannot speak to you and me. Hark! In the next room, his voice is sufficiently clear and emphatic. It seems he knows how to speak to his contemporaries. Bashful or bold, then, he will know how to make us seniors very unnecessary. Love that. Cool. Okay, so
this question of consistency, though, a little bit different. For that, I'm going to go to the bottom of page two.
Okay.
Right on that last paragraph there. Society everywhere is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members. Society is a joint stock company in which the members agree, for the better securing of his bread to each shareholder, to surrender the liberty and culture of the eater. The virtue, in most request, is conformity. Self-reliance is its aversion. It loves not realities and creators, but names and customs. So very much this idea of the status quo, you know, keeping things the way they are. I might even call it consistency.
So you're talking about a consistency relative to society.
Right.
Okay.
Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. Okay. Page three.
So one attribute of the self-reliant individual who trusts him or herself is that they do not harmonize with the status quo.
Yeah, I think Emerson says that. I don't know how I feel about
okay.
that, but
okay.
but yeah, I think so.
Okay, so that's one type of inconsistency.
Sure.
So there's a discord between what the individual does and the society, and that goes back to the... I didn't ask you, Dr. Russo, so what was the reaction of the Theosophical Society? Were they, you know, like, did they get it, or were they pissed off, or...
I don't know.
How'd they react to
Christian Murray? I couldn't really say specifically. I mean, I think it was obviously somewhat awkward because, you know, there had been all sorts of, like, newspaper publicity, like Theosophical Society identifies world teacher kind of thing. And then it was like he came out and said, forget this whole thing. And it was like, oh. But it's a slightly awkward thing. I think they tried to, like, smooth it over somehow as being, like, still somehow in line with, you know, his mission, but he wasn't really, like, presenting anything in the terms that the Theosophical teaching had ever been in, and he, like, went on to just write his own, really, like, give talks and stuff that were transcribed into many books, whatever, that were, like, more of an experiential type of investigation that didn't really have any kind of, like, jargon of... any philosophical jargon or any kind of, like, religious terminology, and he was very much against, like, organized religious traditions insofar as they lead to, like, a rigid, static, mechanical repetition of stuff where that's just meaningless. And I think Emerson is... I think when Emerson is saying, like, about nonconformity, I mean, cool. At the same time, I think just to not conform for the sake of, like, being a nonconformist is also potentially stupid and fake. There are many elements of society that if one were spontaneous from the true core of your being, you might not necessarily, like, contradict or come into any conflict with, per se. And obviously it would also depend on what social situation you existed in. So I think just to not conform for the sake of not conforming is not really what he's talking about, but maybe something to the effect that, you know, genius in some way is, like, unprecedented, so to speak, or it comes from some place that doesn't that's, like, creative and, I don't know, branches out into something that's new, just because in order to be expressive of something it has to be, like, new instead of a repetition of what is old. And something like that, so that it's not necessarily like you're contradicting society just for the sake of doing it. I also feel like I need to throw in, I think you made a good point, Hope, Dr. May, which was that, you know, genius and, like, Einstein are not exactly synonymous, even if Einstein was a genius. That there are many expressions of genius, and this is a point that I think is important in many respects. And when it comes to, like, Aristotle, since Aristotle is always coming up on this show, I think. it's like,
Aristotle and Walk the Line.
Yeah, okay. When it comes to, like, you know, rational intelligence or whatever, same story. You know, genius and rational intelligence are not, you know, limited to, like, brainy thoughts that are smart. But, I mean, you could be, like, you could display genius in how you, like, relate to your friend kind of thing. How you deal with some weird, complicated situation or what have you, or, you know, there are a billion and one ways you could, like, show intelligence in how you live your life. And so it's not just about, like, a bunch of theories that are complex and smart. And I think when he's talking about genius, I mean, I take it to encompass that whole broad range of, you know, creation of, like, art and poetry and philosophy, but also, like, just down to the bedrock of your self, your being, and your daily life, how you live. And so if you do that by following what someone else said you're supposed to do, and that's your motivation, it somehow is, like, inauthenticated right away. whereas it's somehow it comes from the core of your being, then it's more authentic, and maybe it conforms or it's like the way society is, and maybe not, but it can't be directed to fit in with society, because even if it's a good thing to do, it's being done for the wrong reason in that situation.
I want to say a couple things, if I may. And one is going back to this idea of conformity, and I think Dr. Russo, is this an accurate interpretation of what you were saying at the beginning of your discussion, that you're sort of like weaving in your own way, the truth, like, of the time. Did you say that at one point, or am I having...
I don't recall saying that, but okay, I wish.
Excellent.
That's cool.
Well, anyway, you said something that reminded me, I actually have it in front of me, and we were talking before the show about the relationship amongst William James, who we have done several shows on, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, pragmatism, Emerson, individualism, pragmatism, Emerson, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I have in front of me a passage from Pragmatism, the essay, A New Name for Some Old Ways of Thinking by William James. I'm reading this for the sake of glossing on what we mean by non-conforming with the status quo. And he says, true ideas lead us, namely, through the acts and other ideas which they instigate, into or up to or towards other parts of experience with which we feel all the while, such feeling being among our potentialities, that the original ideas remain in agreement. The connections and transitions come to us from point to point as being progressive, harmonious, and satisfactory. The function of agreeable leading is what we mean by an ideas verification. So, like, in a sense, the new idea is new. It hasn't been said this way before. But it's genius because it resonates and makes sense of the ideas that preceded it. And so I just want to read this passage because Emerson and James were friends, and this may be the type of thing that he's talking about, that a genius is not a total nonconformist who is shunning society, but is leading society in a way that makes greater sense of what has gone before it. And going back to this point about abolition, you know, the slavery, abolition of slavery, I'm pretty sure in the Metaphysical Club, the book, the point is made that at first Emerson was against the abolitionist movement because he saw it as conformist, but he later then saw it as actually resonating with his core principles of, like, divine truth. Again, the first sentence, to believe in your own thought, what is true for you in your private heart is true for all men, that is genius. It's this idea that, like, slaves are human beings and everybody knows that deep down inside, and so there was something true, universally true about the abolitionist movement. He didn't see it at first, he just saw it as conformist. But in any case, I just wanted to read that passage to make the connection between James and Emerson, period. And if I may, since we're on this idea of listening to your true core self, the show description mentions Lady Gaga, so I feel like we should mention Lady Gaga at the very least. And I just want to say that I had heard of her. Dr. Russo, have you heard of Lady Gaga?
Sure.
Do you know who she is and, like, what her deal is?
Basically.
And how would you sum that up?
Well, my clearest image of Lady Gaga is her hanging from a string with blood gushing all out from her, spinning around in concert while she was singing, and blood was flying everywhere.
Right. And Mike, how would you characterize Lady Gaga? What's your image of her?
I have a few different, you know, experiences with the Gaga effect. Both are all kind of odd, you know, this, it's visually capturing usually. weird renditions of old music. I would call her off the beaten path. That's my own.
Over the top?
Maybe a little bit, yep.
Okay. Well, I had heard of her, didn't really know anything about her, except that, yeah, she's sort of like this over-the-top weirdo. But she did an interview on 60 Minutes just this past Sunday. I did put a link to that interview on our show resources page, ethicstalk.cmish.edu. And I'm bringing this up because it goes to several points that we have been talking about. One is the idea that genius expresses itself in many ways. And you may, in fact, watch that interview and come away with the belief that Lady Gaga is a genius. Okay? You know, and what she's doing is, like, strategic. The end may be wrong. It seems like right now the end, like the that for the sake of which she does everything, is fame. She talks about, you know, this uses the phrase the sociology of fame, and she studies fame and the art of fame like an academic. And this is why she's so outrageous, because she's calculating to have the spotlight on her at all times. So maybe she's a genius in that way. On the other hand, you may think she's not a genius. There's something seriously wrong with her. And she's also someone who talks about the core self. And so I raise this question now, since we're on, like, okay, listening to your core self, and Mike's point about, well, you could be wrong. You know, like, can you, if you listen to your core self, can you know all the time that you're hearing it wrong, is what I'm asking. And it could be like Lady Gaga is listening to her core self, and maybe that's all that we mean by right, to listen to your core self, like that is truth and correctness. Or do we want to say something like, your core self can be wrong? I'm sorry, this is a big question and we have 18 minutes remaining, but really the question that I'm getting at is, you know, about subjectivism and all that. So if anybody wants to take a stab or talk about Lady Gaga.
Well, I mean, I think that, I don't know about Lady Gaga, but that question you raised is a big one, and I think it is one thing that while I read Self-Reliance, you know, I wondered about and was skeptical, so to speak, about you know, following yourself and that line that I believe you read it earlier, Hope, to believe in yourself that your own heart is like true for everyone is genius. I don't know, not necessarily like, you know, Hitler. He was totally convinced. You know what I'm saying? you know, your question, I think you were like shifting around a certain point, which maybe was, you know, if you listen to yourself and somehow what you hear is wrong or twisted or just bad, are we going to say then therefore that was not really your like true self? You could try to say that and maintain the idea that, you know, to follow the core of your own being would necessarily mean to like do things that are good and exemplify genius. That might be predicated on the idea that like the core self is just genius of everyone. And anyone who does something that is like abhorrent is in some way not really in touch with their own true self.
Yeah, just with the Hitler example. Yeah, page 5. I mean, Emerson can definitely be read in a way where Hitler is, you know, the self-reliant, self-trusting man. I mean, you can definitely, like, there is a way of reading Emerson such that Hitler is an example. And that may seem so obnoxious to us, but to, I wish I could find the passage quickly, but perhaps one of you can. There's a part where he basically says, maybe at the time something looks awkward and twisted in yourself or whatever, but if you take the long view, I'm paraphrasing, you actually see it makes total sense. This is the line where he says, like, the straightest voyage is a zigzag of many lines. Sorry, I can't find the right page. But going back to Hitler, how does that relate to Hitler? Well, you know, were it not for Hitler, one could argue, we would not have the notion of human rights. We would not have that concept actually recognized by the law, and that Hitler played a fundamental role in awakening us, humanity, to something. And although, like, maybe we're too close in time to Hitler to appreciate. I'm really reaching here, but I'm trying to, think how Emerson thinks, perhaps. If we take the long view and we see, like, he played a crucial role, and it was because he was following his, you know, true voice, if you will, and that actually did end up helping us. I know it's out there, but hey, I'm being an Emersonian and saying things that may freak people out.
Well, this question about, I think you're basically asking at some point, you know, is Emerson appealing to subjectivism or something like that? I don't know. I don't know if I have an answer for that question. But as to this question about, like, you know, can one's true or core self be wrong? That sort of question. The whole time you guys were talking, I was trying to come up with some sort of telling, you know, example, which I failed to, so instead you get to listen to a boring one. You know, it might be I might have some core belief. Let me rewind a little bit. You know, I find it interesting that as children, at least this is my experience, we're all taught that, like, here's a fact, here's an opinion. There's a dichotomy between the two. You know, a fact is some truth about the world. You know, we don't have to get in discussions
about
truth.
Snow is white.
Very good. Snow is white. An opinion is something completely different, right? My opinion is that ice cream tastes good. Clearly, you know, there's no fact about the world which conforms or fails to conform to my opinion. Well, that's what I was taught as a child. You know, since then I've realized it's a lot more complicated than that. For example, I might have the opinion that Dr. May's hair is blonde. Clearly, you know, that's an incorrect opinion. That would be a false opinion. Now, if you're doubting my point here, then let me just use Dr. May's example. It could be that, you know, in my truest core self, I have this belief that it's snowing. Concurrently, I have this core belief that it's a sunny day and it's not snowing. Now, your first reaction might be, okay, you know, you're having some kind of identity crisis or you're schizophrenic or something like that. But, you know, upon further reflection, what you've encountered is an inconsistency in my belief system, in my thought, in my core self. So, again, I know it's not a very telling point. I'll try to come up with a better one. But what I'm getting at is, look, yes, this is my opinion. This is my feeling about what is. That doesn't stop anyone from saying, look, that's ludicrous. How can it be snowing and not snowing at the same time? You know, a similar proposition. I could say something like, you know, X is Y. And then I could think, well, X is not Y. Actually, X is Z. These two things, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of opinion you're talking about, how abstract it is. It's very difficult to reconcile these two beliefs or core selves. Mm-hmm. So I guess this would be my rejection of subjectivity, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the core self can be wrong.
And then just to relate to this idea, page 5 again. Suppose you should contradict yourself, what then? And he's basically saying, like, so what? And then he says, second paragraph, and this is a very famous, the first sentence of the second paragraph, it's a very famous passage from this essay, a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. And then he says, with consistency, a great soul has nothing to do. Now, Mike, you're talking about propositional inconsistency or
right.
Belief inconsistency. And on my page 5, see what it says at the top? On my page 5, it says, it's not propositional. So when, insofar as Emerson is lauding inconsistency, I don't think he's just talking about propositional or belief inconsistency, and I think he's also talking about inconsistency of character. Dr. Roos and I were having this conversation before. But if you look at the bottom of page 4 is when he starts talking about consistency. The other terror that scares us from self-trust is our consistency. Now, I just want to point out, like, we've been talking about consistency with society, like the status quo. Okay, that was one type of consistency.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going inner. And we're talking about belief consistency, so consistency of belief, of proposition, and also consistency of character. And that actually, as I read these pages, Emerson is saying that this consistency holds us back. I've been talking too much, so anybody want to say anything about Hitler?
Well, I would throw in about consistency that I agree with what you're saying, that he brings it up in regard to, as I read it, when you've like done things a certain way or acted a certain way, then people expect you to continue to like do the same kinds of things and to act the same or similar way, and maybe also to hold the same belief, you know, as you did yesterday kind of thing. And I take his point to be that it's almost like a self-conformity that he's going against, to conform to your past self just because that's how you were last week. It could lead you to being like inauthentic. If your deepest conviction changes, you have to like follow that. This reminds me, by the way, of a totally anecdotal story, and I don't remember it specifically. Maybe someone else knows, or I'm sure it could be found on the internet where all information is to be found. Which is a story about Abraham Lincoln when he was a lawyer at one point before he was president. One morning, he was in the courtroom, like, arguing some point.
It's in the metaphysical club.
Okay, and later in the afternoon, he was in the same court with the same judge arguing exactly the opposite thing. And the judge was like, what the hell? I mean, weren't you in here this morning arguing exactly the opposite of what you're telling me now? And he said, yes, and how wrong I was this morning. So whatever the truth or the real motivation behind that statement may have been or whatever, I think what Emerson is getting at is, you know, if your conviction changes, then it's inauthentic to try to discard it because in the past you have said or done, you know, X, and so you can't now contradict it. That leads to like a falsity in your being. And at one point he refers to people who follow the conventions and nearly like stick to what they think they're supposed to do as, he says, I forget on what page, but it's kind of early, not being false in this or that particular, but being false, like completely in everything that they do, in all the particulars. Because in a way, it's like even if they do a thing that in itself is somehow good or reflects truth or whatever, their like way of doing it is inauthentic. And I think in a way, I mean, his idea about self-reliance is harmonious with the idea of like being authentic, even if it means changing your ways or your views or whatever. And also, I think it's important to just throw in one last thing, and I think you touched on it before, Hope, but he gives an analogy that's very nice where he says, the inequalities of the peaks of the Andes and the Himalayan mountains, like the going up and down, doesn't really change the shape of the Earth. It's still spherical. Like those ups and downs are nothing compared to the spherical shape of the Earth. And so likewise, he says, so like the inconsistency in behavior of the genius or the self-reliant person looked at, you know, overall, doesn't really do anything to the, like, integrity of their character as a whole, being analogous to, like, the whole spherical shape of the Earth. So the inconsistency, quote-unquote, is really just the varying ways that the same thing expresses itself in different situations.
Yeah, that's on page 5, and I finally found the passage about the ship. It's, page 5 has 4 paragraphs, the last one being the biggest, and it's in the last paragraph. There will be an agreement in whatever variety of actions, so they be each honest and natural in their hour. For of one will, the actions will be harmonious, however unlike they seem. So he's talking about a type of consistency here, right? So they're honest and natural in their hour. Then he goes on to say, these varieties are lost sight of at a little distance, at a little height of thought. One tendency unites them all. The voyage of the best ship is a zigzag line of 100 tacks. See the line from a sufficient distance, and it straightens itself to the average tendency. Your genuine action will explain itself, and will explain you other your other genuine actions. Your conformity explains nothing. So anyway, there's the passage, and we can talk about, you know, this at the level of the individual, and the individual being inconsistent internally with belief and or character, externally with society. But I would say we could also, you know, talk this way about humanity, you know, going back to Hitler and human rights and the progression of law and so forth. And again, you know, we can look back at slavery, and this is when Emerson is writing, and say, you know, horrible. But again, perhaps if we take a longer view, which we can't see within our lifetimes because perhaps we're too close to it, we see it as a completely logical expression of something that's true and real. I'm just putting it out there as a possibility. Period. 3 minutes remaining.
So, go ahead.
No, I had nothing to say.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. To me, that's an expression of my subjectivist point of view, to me. Emerson is seeming more subjectivist by the moment, and I don't know how I feel about that. Unfortunately, I walked right into your trap about propositional inconsistency. However, it just really seems to me that this is subjectivism, and I want to say, look, you know, we can appeal to each core self we want all day, but at the end of the day, you know, Hitler was still a psycho. No, you're still a murdering, racist bastard, but...
Well, that's why, you know, that's one point of view.
Right.
And what I'm saying is we can at least entertain, you know, a perspective in which we see his role as absolutely indispensable to the development of human rights.
Sure, absolutely. You know, and similar arguments have been made about, like, the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Look, this is this terrible thing that was done, but look at the positive outcome and ended the war. Now, while I'm willing to admit that, you know, absolutely all day long, I'm not willing to admit that Hitler's core self was, you know, somehow golden because it was authentic or something like that. I mean, I'm just not comfortable with that.
Hmm. Dr. Russo, with 1 minute remaining?
Well, what can I say? I mean, I think that as far as subjectivism goes, I don't, in my reading of Emerson, I wasn't really necessarily thinking he has to be committed to that. I don't know overall if he was or whatever, but I think really what he's saying is maybe it's better to just use the word authenticity, and say that even if someone is like, you know, as far as like truth goes, subjectivism with regard to truth, you know, maybe the statement is a true statement, and so, you know, it is snowing outside, or 2 + 2 = 4 is like a true statement that's an objective fact, and you can have your own opinion on it all you want, but you'll just be wrong if you think 2 + 2 = 4.
Right.
Fine. But I think if when it comes to, like, authenticity and why you believe in what you believe and this kind of thing, even if you repeat true sentences, it doesn't mean that you really know anything, per se. And so truth in the sense of, like, authentic knowledge or authentic being is a thing that has to be sort of, like, original, so to speak, or is like subjective, quote unquote, in the sense that it's like it's in yourself. What it is that differentiates like real knowledge from just saying sentences that are true is something about how the stuff in you is or relates to the facts. And so it's like subjectivist, but it's not just like opinion and anything you believe is like true for you and that whole thing.
Well, with 10 seconds remaining, I just want to end with a William James one sentence from Pragmatism. An idea is true so long as to believe it is profitable to our lives. So you've been listening to Ethics Talk, and we will be on Sunday. Is that correct?
We will be on Sunday.
Sunday. So next Tuesday we will not have a show. Sunday we will. And ethicstalk.cmish.edu. Thank you for listening. Bye.